Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner.
Oh, excuse me. Please be seated. You don't understand through the whole argument.
The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Ernest & Young versus Pacific Mutual Life Insurance.
May it please the court, Mr. Ralph Miller, present an argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Disregarding 70 years of established Texas law without explanation, the Dallas Court of Appeals relied on part of Section 531 of the Restatement of Tort Second to adopt an unworkable new reason-to-expect standard for common law fraud in Texas. The result is a direct conflict with the Houston 14th District Court's opinion in Cannon versus Methodist Hospital, and the opinion of the Dallas Court in the off-cited case of Bluebell versus Pete Marwick. There are also conflicts with earlier decisions of this court, including the Oil Well Division USF Steel case, the Formosa Plastics case, and the earlier line of cases cited in our briefs. We're grateful the court's going to clarify this confusion and the expansion of litigation it's likely to cause. As the Texas Society of Certified Public Accountants pointed out on page 17 of its amicus brief, this, quote, expansion of the common law definition of fraud leaves professionals without guidance or predictability with regard to future liability. We're here because the court below decided to change Texas law without giving a reason for the change or citing any Texas precedent supporting the change. In fact, this court's cases use an enlightened intent-to-induce-action test that's flexible, well understood by practitioners, and effective. If this court wished to review the tort law of Texas, it should undertake a cost-benefit analysis similar to that the California Supreme Court undertook in its opinion in Merkin versus Wasserman, which is cited in our brief, 858 Pacific 2nd. Now, California law of fraud is different. There's a lot of statutory provisions, and the issue there was different. But what the California court asked is, first of all, is something broken that needs to be fixed? And they concluded that the common law tort of fraud served an important function, in part operating with other torts, such as securities violations and statutory violations and negligent misrepresentation, and that there was no need to change the law.
How broad do you paint the scope of who should be able to sue an accounting company for a misrepresentation in a report like this?
We believe everyone who is in the zone where there was an intent to induce action.
And where do you draw the lines of that zone?
We think that obviously is a factual issue in most cases. In these facts, it's easy to say that we are outside that zone, but it can include a limited group.
But if it's a fact issue in most cases.
Pardon me?
If it's a fact issue in most cases, as you just said, then doesn't that depart from your earlier request for us to create a bright line?
I think there already is a bright line, Justice Abbott. We believe that the bright line is an intent to induce action, and these facts are helpful, I think, on that. Let me just say
an intent to induce action from who?
An intent to induce action from either a limited group or through an intermediary, from someone that the fraud feeser is attempting to influence.
What if all the facts in this case were the same, except that Ernst & Young's audit opinion letter had been written with respect to First Republic?
We don't believe it made any difference. Let me explain
what's
why.
What's the point of an auditor's, a public auditor's opinion in a 10-K or an S-3 if it's not to induce reliance by investors?
First of all, this was in a proxy statement, which is a critical point. This was, first of all, financials that were issued in 1986. They were issued early in 1987 for year in 1986. At a time, that Interfirst was a completely separate bank. The inclusion in the SEC filings was in connection with a merger. And the purpose of those documents was to inform voters, basically the shareholders who were going to vote. That was the type of transaction that was involved. It's very significant, and this is, by the way, this chart was used in the trial court and the court of appeals, but this little tab I put up is different to try to emphasize a key point. These Interfirst notes that were bought by the purchaser had been traded on the open market for years.
the people that were buying these notes were buying from complete third parties.
But why would those investors who are voting on the merger, those shareholders, why would they be interested in Republic Bank's financial position?
Well, the people who are voting on the merger would be interested in those financial statements because they're trading stock for stock. In other words...
Right, they have a financial interest in the strength of the merged entity.
Of course.
And why does an investor who buys a stock or buys an instrument backed by the merged entity any less of a stakeholder?
They might not be any less of a stakeholder, but they are completely outside the intent to induce any action. The key point of fraud is it is an intentional tort. And the tort of fraud in Texas gives certain preferential rights to the intended victim. It strips away, for example, the defense of comparative negligence. It strips away it allows punitive damages and it gives a longer statute of limitations. The key point in fraud is that the people who are intended victims get ahead of the line.
Well, let me just stop you for a minute. You say in your brief that even under the restatement, you would prevail in this case.
That's correct.
So let's look at the reason to expect standard. Well, now, why would let me rephrase my question. Why wouldn't we have a reason to expect that investors in securities backed by this merged entity wouldn't similarly have a stake?
The Court of Appeals found there was a fact issue on reason to expect. And I think we're probably bound by that finding in this court. The reason we think we would prevail under Section 531 of the restatement is best illustrated by Illustration 7 to the restatement, which explains the type of transaction illustration. Illustration 7 says that A, seeking to sell his own lot, publishes some misrepresentations in the newspaper about a group of lots. Someone relies on those misrepresentations, which is certainly foreseeable, and buys a different lot in that subdivision from another person. The restatement says that there is no liability there because the transaction that occurs is not the type of transaction in which the actor intended to induce action. And we think that that is clearly the case here because there is some evidence in the record that perhaps Republic Bank or Interfirst or maybe Arthur Young cared how people voted in this merger.
But the restatement doesn't say intend to induce action. It says reason to expect to act.
There are two parts of the restatement. It says, first, there has to be a reason to expect, and then it continues.
And you would expect this particular class of investors to rely on this type of information.
There is a fact issue raised by the experts as to whether there is a reason to expect. And we think, by the way, the Dallas court misapplied probably reason to expect because the restatement says that reason to expect has to be a special reason to expect. The affidavits in this case are going to create fact issues over this in virtually all kinds of counter cases.
So are you saying if we go with the restatement position, then there is a fact issue? We're bound by that.
No, I'm saying if you go with the restatement and you apply all of the restatement continues. It says one who makes a fraudulent misrepresentation is subject to liability to the person or class of persons whom he intends or has reason to expect to act. And then it continues. Or refrain from action in reliance upon the misrepresentation for pecuniary loss suffered by them through their justifiable reliance in the type of transaction in which he intends or has reason to expect their conduct to be influenced. This was not argued in court below because, frankly, we thought that the Bluebell opinion absolutely controlled, and we thought Texas law in the oil well division case, which talked about the intent to induce action. Justice Greenhill's opinion for the unanimous court says that that's the test. That was going to control. The Dallas court went off and frankly on a tangent and adopted only the first half of Restatement Section 531. They never did an examination of whether it was the same type of transaction.
So when you say type of transaction, you're talking about the merger here. What could we categorize the type of transaction as an investment in the entity?
It's easy to look at that. In all of the restatement illustrations, and frankly in all of the case law that they're synthesizing, it's clear that when the purchaser deals with a third party outside of the group that the person who is charged with fraud is trying to benefit, that is a different type of transaction. There are a couple of good illustrations here. Again, illustration 7, I think, is actually probably the most compelling that I've talked about. But there's also an illustration of a mortgage in the amount of $10,000 secured by a particular land, and if that's replaced by bond issue in the amount of $1 million secured by all the assets of a corporation, the transaction's of a different type.
What if Republic Bank had told Ernst & Young that it needed a good report, not only to induce shareholders to vote for the merger, but also because, as you know, accounting firm, institutional investors look at this kind of information, and we want them to buy these bonds even though they shouldn't. So we want you to help us lie to them. Seems like that would clearly be wrong.
Well, of course, there's no, absolutely nothing in the record like that. But if there were, you could have a fact issue on whether there was an intent to induce action in some group. If these had been convertible securities, for example, if these had been convertible to stock and could have voted, there's a lot of stuff in the proxy statement talking about convertible securities. You can get to the hypothetical that you have there. There might have been some interest in this. But the record is really clear here. Now, all the experts are saying is, gosh, accountants know that all kinds of people look at financials. Frankly, the opinion below would allow an investor in a completely different entity to make a claim. We all know, for example, that when Intel stock goes down, it has a tendency to affect the stock of PC makers, Dell and Compaq and so on. You can postulate under what the Dallas Court of Appeals did that if the audit opinion on Intel has an error in it, they have reason to expect as auditors that people who invest in Compaq and who invest
in... No, because there would be no reliance.
Well, there certainly would be reliance. There's reliance all the time on that because the expectation is that if the chip shipments are down, then PC shipments are going to be down.
No one who buys Compaq stock would be looking at anything done for Intel.
Well, of course, I believe they do, Justice Abbott, in the sense that there's all sorts of indications that different industries move. The theory is that the sale of PC chips are an upstream indication of what the sale of PCs are going to be. So if Intel has its sales of chips down, then that's considered a leading indicator of what's going to happen to the PC market. That was the assumption.
Let's go back to a little bit narrower lines. My example is that let's assume that Ernst & Young had audited First Republic, the merged entity, and the audit letter was done in connection with their 10-K.
Yes, ma'am.
Would the plaintiffs in this case be able to recover on a fraud theory under those facts?
And the assumption further is that there was an intent. What was the purpose of the fraud?
It's the 10-K. That to misrepresent the financial condition of First Republic, the merged entity.
Well, obviously we don't have those facts.
But I
believe the answer is that they would not be able to recover.
And
the reason is that the notes here have nothing to do with the entities. These notes were put out, and they were just going along.
Well, I'm the purchaser, Pacific Mutual, and I'm looking at buying these junk bonds, and I've just learned that First Republic has merged. It's a new entity. I know that they will be backing up these junk bonds. And my decision to purchase or not purchase, why is that not influenced by the financial condition of First Republic?
It may be influenced, and they would have a negligent misrepresentation claim.
Why not a fraud claim if the auditor knowingly misrepresented First Republic's financial condition in a 10-K.
They would not have a fraud claim under existing Texas law or under the restatement if the auditor's alleged fraud was intending to induce a different kind of transaction.
What's a 10-K intended to induce?
Well, I think a 10-K is intended to report on the financial condition of the entity. Again, this wasn't a 10-K, so
that's
not
example.
The fact.
But that's my example. Where would you draw the line? And why wouldn't an investor look at a 10-K, for example, of a publicly held company to decide whether to invest in bonds if that company is backing them?
Well, a 10-K will look, I think, an investor will look at the 10-K of the entity in which they are making an investment. But I would point out that there's a lot of law out there that says that future open market purchasers are an unlimited group, and they may not even have a negligent misrepresentation claim, and they are very broadly out there. But if there is an intent to defraud that group, if there is an intent to induce action by those future purchasers of stock, if you postulate that, you would have a fraud claim. And you could have a fraud claim.
What would the proof look like of intent to induce?
I think the proof would look like some kind of motivation or some kind of a possible causal link between what the auditors were doing and what these these parties who are being intended to, they intend to induce action to do, might do. In this case, for example, there is some evidence, which we dispute, that the auditors wanted the entity to survive, and so they may have puffed up the audit a little bit so that the merger would go through and the entity would survive. That makes sense. That has nothing to do with whether these junk bonds were traded, not traded, what the price was, if they came or went, or anything about that, because essentially that's completely irrelevant. If the proof were that they wanted to get people to vote in a certain way, you'd have a fact issue and go to a jury.
Well, that's my question, Mr. Miller. Isn't your whole argument bottomed on the fact that the audit report was part of the proxy statement and unrelated to the purchase of the junk bonds later on, and therefore that's the missing link on the intent to induce? Is that the underpinning for your argument?
I think the underpinning for our argument is that we absolutely negated any intent to induce action on the part of purchasers of junk bonds.
How did you do that?
Well, first of all, we had an affidavit from the audit partner, Bud Ward, who said we had absolutely no intent to do anything about any of these things. And in fact, there's no evidence in the record that Ernst & Young even knew that these junk bonds existed. The countervailing proof is some experts who say, gosh, auditors know that all kinds of investors rely upon things. Their proof goes to what the Dallas Court of Appeals did, which is to look at expectation of reliance. It does not go to intent to induce action.
So it's not critical to your analysis that Ernst & Young approved the use of the opinions on the audit in connection with the proxy statement related to the merger, as opposed to using the opinions on the audit for any other purpose?
That's not critical to our opinion. As long as they did not intend to induce some action by what they did on the parties who are making a claim, these people are outside the zone. And by the way, I mean, the people who ought to be in line first and have in fact been in line and have already had other lawsuits are the people who were voting on the merger. And the purpose of fraud is to reward and put a recovery in the hands of the people who are the targets of the fraud. Here you have these remote parties who really don't have any reason to be defrauded, and they come in without regard to any of their negligence. I mean, there's a lot of comparative negligence evidence here, which is completely irrelevant to fraud case. I see my time is up. I'd like to reserve a little bit more time unless there are any more questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Bruce Budner will present argument for respondent.
What was the evidence concerning the scope of the expectation of reliance, other than what your expert may have said?
Well, we have two experts, Your Honor. In addition to that, we had an employee of Pacific Mutual who discussed the industry.
But there was no evidence indicating any expectation of reliance either by the defendant or by anyone affiliated with the bank.
Actually, I believe there was, Your Honor. And that evidence was in the form of an admission by Bud Ward himself, who Mr. Miller referred to, in which he acknowledged that he and Ernst & Young knew that when they prepared these audit opinions, and again when they consented for the audit opinions to be filed with the merger documents with the SEC, that the public investors would rely on those documents, that it was not just for the limited purpose of the shareholders.
But doesn't that get us back to the new or should have known standard? And let me ask you a question. Who did Ernst & Young intend to induced to act by its filing? Who did it seek to influence by agreeing to let its audit report be filed?
Well, if we are looking at intent as opposed to reason to expect, and I'll focus on that, I actually believe that the evidence, there's evidence that creates a fact question on intent. And I believe they intended to induce anyone that was an investor or a potential investor during a period of time in which that audit opinion was still current.
What is the evidence that supports that intent?
The knowledge coupled with action. The knowledge by Ernst & Young of the realities of the securities industry and the action that followed, which was okay, we sign off, we will take another fee, and we'll sign off on having this filed with the merger.
But they signed off on Republic Bank, and nothing in their audit did it said that the merged entity would have a strong financial position.
They did audit Republic Bank, but the audit went to the merged company, because the merger really wasn't a merger, it was an acquisition, and the record is clear that what happened as a result of that merger was InterFirst was acquired as a wholly owned subsidiary.
But my point is that the audit only covered the pre-merger condition. That audit said nothing about what the financial condition of Republic Bank would look like after the acquisition.
I disagree with that, Your Honor. When the consent was given to the filing of that audit opinion in connection with the merger documents some 6 months later, it was reviewed and updated, and the consent was given.
The consent was given again, but it only dealt with an audit as of 12/31/86 of Republic Bank, not an audit of what Republic Bank would look like after that date, after it had merged with InterFirst.
I submit, Your Honor, that in this instance, there's no difference, because it was clearly understood, and the record is replete with evidence of this, that the financial wherewithal of this acquisition came from Republic Bank. InterFirst was not being looked to as a source of financial strength. The financial strength that the public looked to, and the financial strength that my client looked to, was Republic Bank.
But my point is, in acquiring InterFirst, it had liabilities, presumably, that might have affected the bottom line of Republic Bank after it made the acquisition, and the audit does not speak to what that new entity will look like, does it?
That is correct.
So how could Ernst & Young have intended someone to rely on what First Republic would look like when its audit only dealt with Republic Bank pre-merger?
Because I think it knew, Ernst & Young knew, when it signed off on this and consented to its audit being included in the merger documents, that investors were looking to the strength of Republic. That's what was touted about this acquisition. Admittedly, InterFirst brought some liabilities to the table, but it turned out that's not what brought this entity down. It was the Republic loan portfolio that went south that brought this entity down, and that's what Ernst & Young falsely audited.
What are the limitations on the liability that you're suggesting in this case? If your position is that Ernst & Young intended the investing public to rely upon the audit opinion that was contained in this proxy statement, does that mean that there were no limits? Anyone who says that they read the proxy statement and purchased something as a result of it, whether it was stock or debt instruments or whatever, that they're liable to everyone? Or are there any limits on the parameters of the theory that would arise under this transaction?
Well, if we're looking at intent, I don't know if Your Honor is intending to limit this just to an intent standard or also to a reason to expect
standard.
Start
with intent.
I think that there are limitations. Certainly trade creditors would not be within the group, because these public filings are not for the benefit of trade creditors. They're for the benefit of investors, and the securities laws are clear, and the cases interpreting them are clear as to that's what the purpose is.
Why does it have to be for the benefit of? Why can't you make the argument, I never would have sold them $5 million worth of computers on credit if they weren't, if I didn't know they had publicly filed the documents that they have to file, which include an audit by a responsible accounting firm?
Well, under the reason to expect standard, our evidence is that in the securities industry, as opposed to in a lending arrangement, in the securities industry, an accountant knows who's going to rely on its audit. And we don't have evidence as to what other transaction might have been induced by this sort of audit.
But if you did have evidence, it would put them within the scope.
I think the reason to expect standard, and particularly when you look at Section 536 of the restatement, it talks about when an audit is publicly filed, It's for the benefit of those, for the protection of a particular class of people. It's for, that is what helps us to understand the meaning of reason to expect. And what we have here is filed under the securities laws, not under some banking regulations, filed under the securities laws for the protection of investors.
I thought this was for the protection so that the shareholders would be able to know how to vote with respect to the acquisition.
Well, that was certainly one of the purposes of filing the merger documents. But
and the audit opinion was part of the merger documents.
It was part of the merger documents. And in the merger document, it specifically said Republic Bank is backing the securities of Interfer.
I understand. But then that takes me back to my question is what the limitations are as to who could have a good claim against Ernst & Young for allowing this audit opinion to be filed in this kind of document with the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Allow me to continue that answer. I think I got distracted.
That's okay.
First of all, only people that can demonstrate that there was an intentionally false statement, a fraudulent statement, not a mere negligent misrepresentation. Second, only people who can demonstrate actual reliance, and that's very important here. This is not a fraud on the market kind of an allegation we're making where we're asking for a presumption of reliance. We're saying only the people that can come into court and say, we read this.
Read? What was it that you, just the proxy statement?
The audit opinion that was contained in the proxy statement.
The petitioner's brief said you didn't see the audit report, doesn't it?
It says that, and they're incorrect.
Okay.
The Court of Appeals cited in its opinion some of the evidence where we talk about that, and I can point the court to some right now. Larry Card's affidavit in paragraph 8 says, I recall that either I personally or someone under my supervision, who then reported to me, carefully reviewed these written materials, including the audited financial information opined upon by Arthur Young and Company.
The audited financial information, not the audit letter.
Well, I think that included the ultimate opinion. It talks about the opinion in other parts of that affidavit. The opinion letter is something that Mr. Card placed emphasis on in his affidavit. So we've got have to prove intentional falsity. We have to prove actual and justifiable reliance, which we have evidence of in this record. We have to prove, as I said before, a reason to expect standard. In other words, if we take guidance from Section 536, what was the purpose of this filing? For whose protection was this information required to be publicly filed? So we've got that issue. And then we have the temporal issue of a limited time span. These audit opinions aren't good forever. Everybody knows that. The investing public knows that. We have evidence here that this one was still occurring. It still was fresh enough when we made our investment just about a half a year after the merger documents were filed with the newly consented audit opinion in it. We have evidence that we were within that time span where we were justified in relying on the currency of that report.
So, in other words, then, your position is that we can't have a bright line rule in terms of which investors may or may not be in the zone, so to speak, and instead we're looking at a case-by-case determination based on the evidence that is presented as to whether or not a particular plaintiff can meet the required elements.
Well, I know this court and every court likes bright line rules, but I think that's correct. We can't have one. But we do have standards. The reason to expect standard is clearly defined in the restatement.
But would it be your position that if the auditing firm permits its audit letters to be filed with the SEC, then the universe of people who could sue them for fraud is any investor? Assuming they meet the justifiable reliance and actual reliance, they buy the stock, that they have an action for fraud, that there was a false report.
Well, subject to the limitations that I stated to Justice Hankinson, I think that's right.
And I think that when Ernst & Young takes a fee...
And that's because it was filed with the SEC, or what makes the universe all investors?
The public filing and the fact that the purpose of the statute requiring public filing is for the protection of investors.
All right, let me follow up with you on that. In your brief, page 17, you say Ernst & Young knew and intended that its false report be included in the Republic Bank's annual reports in order to satisfy legal requirements.
Yes.
What legal requirements?
I'm talking about the Securities and Exchange Rule.
Well, which ones that you refer to? In the next sentence, you say the purpose of these requirements is to ensure that institutional investors in securities backed by the audited entity were receiving accurate and fair information. What requirements are you looking at that addresses specifically institutional investors and securities backed by the audited entity?
I don't know of any specific portion of the securities rule that relate to, that have a specific provision protecting investors in securities backed by the entity, but they are generally for the protection of investors in that entity.
Is there anything in evidence other than the proxy statement?
There was the S-3 registration. There was the 10-K.
Okay, so you talk about annual report.
The 10K.
The 10K was in evidence?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. Or certainly references to, I think the whole report
the 10K of Republic Bank, not of First Republic.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct.
Pre-merger.
Yes, the audit was clearly done pre-merger. We don't argue that the audit was done at the time of the merger. It was updated and consented to at the time of the merger.
The portion of the restatement we've been talking about that references the type of transaction, let me see if I can find the language, in the type of transaction in which he has reason to expect their conduct to be influenced, is that a question of law or fact? Do we decide what type of transaction was intended to be influenced?
I think that... there are lines, legal lines, that this court can draw. And then there's a fact-finding as to whether it's a type of transaction. But if this court is going to try to craft some sort of bright-line rule, I ask the court to look carefully at Section 534 of the restatement, which talks about types of transactions. And it specifically refers to, and I'm reading, it talks about multiple types of transactions. And in its comment C, it says, a statement by the directors of a corporation of its financial position, whether published by it or by a public official to whom the corporation is by statute required to furnish it, is made with the intention or expectation of inducing the public to deal with the corporation in any one of a variety of different ways in which the financial status of the corporation is material. So I think the restatement clearly contemplated not just one kind of transaction, this wasn't just for the stockholders who were voting on the merger. This was for people that dealt with the corporation in any number of a variety of different ways.
One thing I'm having trouble with is distinguishing between knew or should have known and reason to expect.
Well, the Dallas Court of Appeals, of course, drew a distinction by talking about affirmative knowledge.
Well, it seems like they drew a distinction but applied reason to expect.
You know, I noticed that was a criticism that Ernst & Young leveled at the Court of Appeals. And without trying to protect the Court of Appeals, perhaps they did have an inconsistency between a comment they made and a footnote. But they didn't need to have that inconsistency. There is plenty of evidence that Ernst & Young had reason to expect, had affirmative knowledge, that investors are out there, that they were actively involved in these merger negotiations. So they had all sorts of affirmative knowledge, including the knowledge that I've mentioned to you, that Bud Ward, their audit engagement partner, admitted to. So they had the knowledge about the realities of the securities industry. They had the knowledge that investors such as Pacific Mutual would invest or might invest in these stocks and would rely on these audit opinions.
Do they have any knowledge about InterFirst junk bonds or InterFirst debt obligations at all? Any stocks, bonds that InterFirst had
I believe the record does reflect that they had knowledge, that these bonds were mentioned in the securities filings, in the S-3, I believe, that were filed with the...
But that's the company's S-3. That's not Ernst & Young's opinion. Is there any knowledge that Ernst & Young had any knowledge about the junk at the time that they did this audit, at the time they consented to include it in SEC filing?
Ernst & Young admitted that they were intimately involved in the merger negotiations, that they were intimate in the advice.
But what evidence is there, if any, about the junk bonds or InterFirst bonds in general?
I frankly don't know whether there is any evidence in the record from Bud Ward, for example, saying, I knew specifically about these 12.75% notes, which I don't want to quibble, but Larry Card, in his affidavit, disputes the characterization of them as junk bonds.
Mr. Vedder, one quick question. By the time that your client made the purchase, was there an audit of First Republic publicly available?
No. The only audit that was available that was relevant to all this was the audit that Ernst &
Young. So the merger had occurred in June, and there was no second quarter audit that was done, 10-K or 10-Q done, or even like that, on First Republic that was publicly available by July 22nd?
That's my understanding that there was not.
Would this court's adoption of the reason to expect language from Section 531 of the restatement affect a change in Texas law on fraud?
I don't think so. I know that that's Ernst & Young's position that it does, but I think it reads these cases far more narrowly than they can fairly be read. I think what Ernst & Young is suggesting that this court do is apply in fraud cases the standard that the American Law Institute created for who may sue in a negligent misrepresentation case. And yet, in those cases, the court or the ALI says that they intentionally created a standard for negligent misrepresentation that was much narrower than for fraud.
The current Texas law has an element that there must be an intent to induce reliance. And isn't the reason to expect that someone's going to rely on the representation different, and isn't that changing the intent element of fraud law in Texas?
I think that if it's a change, it's a massage of the rule. It's a massage to make the rule comport with the realities of the financial markets today. And in fact, the realities of new communications today. We are no longer a face-to-face society the way we once were. And when we make statements that go out there, I think we have a reason to expect, even though we may not have intended a specific person to induce. Ernst & Young can't say, if they stand up in front of a big crowd and shoot a rifle, that they didn't intend to hit the person that got hit. And I think that's, in essence, what they're saying here today.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Miller, are you asking for a bright line rule, or are we looking at this on a case-by-case basis, looking at the elements of the cause of action, deciding whether or not an accounting firm can prevail as a matter of law based on the evidence presented?
Justice Hankinson, we're asking for Texas law, as it has always existed, to continue to apply, which does provide a bright line that allows summary judgment in fraud cases frequently.
But that would be evaluating the evidence on a case-by-case basis as presented in the record on the summary judgment motion.
Well, I think basically all summary judgment motions have to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis, of course, but there are many instances like this one and the illustrations in the restatement where summary judgment is now possible under Texas law, and everybody agrees it's not a fraud case, which changes the whole dynamic of whether the case can be settled or not. Let me give you a good example of one of the problems this is going to create. And I think your point was very well taken, that there is no limit to liability if this reason to expect standard is adopted, especially if only part of the restatement is adopted. Assume we had a dot-com company here in Silicon Prairie that was a small company with a few employees and a few shareholders and just a little bit of debt, and it wanted an audit. Right now, that's going to be a pretty cheap audit. If it's known that it is looking at a stock-for-stock trade with Microsoft, for example, what the Court of Appeals has said is that the auditors or the attorneys who work for that .com company are now exposed to the downstream liability that might be caused by Microsoft, by all the people down the way. Right now, that is not anything that Texas law is going to countenance. We're not going to have a trial on that. We're going to be able to resolve it on summary judgment.
If they don't lie, they won't be.
Pardon me?
Not if they don't lie, they won't be. I mean, it's one thing to say if you make a mistake, you don't exercise correct duty of care, your ripples shouldn't go forever. But if you make an intentional misrepresentation, it's harder to justify that.
Well, it certainly is. And by the way, the transferred intent argument, which Mr. Budner raised at the end, does not apply in fraud. Section 531 illustration 3, for example, 2, make it clear that transferred intent is a criminal intent doctrine, the bullet that ricochets. But the key point, we use this chart, we pass it out to the court, is that there are a series of elements of fraud in Texas. We use this in the trial court in this form. The focus now is on this element, the intent to defraud the parties who are claiming. False representation, fact issues have been raised on it. We don't think there is a false representation. And the Court of Appeals said there are fact issues on the rest of these. But this is actually the brightest line we have in fraud law, because it does draw a circle, and we can see from time to time who is outside that circle. If you eliminate that, you make fraud the tort of the new millennium. Do you remember how we had Deceptive Trade Practice Act cases showing up in the 1980s?
Just, Mr. Miller, you just lost me on where you just said that there's basically a line to be drawn around that element, which sounds like a bright line test. Where is the line to be drawn?
But the line to be drawn.
How are you asking us to draw it?
Well, I think the line is already drawn in the case law. If you look at the oil well division opinion, for example, Justice Greenhill's language there is intent to induce action. If you look at the Westcliff versus Wall case, it's intent to influence. The line is that there are only certain people who are intended to be influenced. If you look at the illustrations in the restatement, there are many transactions when it's clear that a fraudfeasor could have no rational intent to influence or induce action for bystanders and people who are around. Now, it's much easier for a plaintiff to show that they had some recognition that a bystander might rely. It's a completely different issue.
Let me ask you, in the merger documents, I understand it specifically says that First Republic Bank is backing Interfirst Bonds. Is that right?
I don't believe that is. I have not seen that in the merger documents. The evidence in the record is that there's a supplemental indenture.
Well, I don't need to. Presume with me that the documents say that.
I'll make that assumption.
Okay, or something to that effect. And what's the purpose of them wanting to make that representation? I mean, it benefits First Republic for these bonds to be sold, doesn't it?
Well, no, it doesn't. These bonds are completely irrelevant to the future of this business. These bonds were sent out, the money was given to the business, and they don't care whether the bonds try higher or lower because they're just being traded out here. When the redemption time comes, they pay the same amount whether the price has gone up or down. People have bought them, people have sold them, the same people have held them the whole time. There's absolutely no way that the trading of these bonds, suggested in the record or in reality, can have any effect at all on First Republic or Republic Bank or Interfirst, because these bonds have been sent out here and they've been on the market. The only time they have to deal with them is when they have to pay them, and they pay them the same whether Pacific Mutual bought or whatever they paid or whatever happened. And that's a critical fact in this case. I'm glad you pointed out, because that's where we draw the bright line. When we can see that it can't possibly make any difference. In illustration 7, for example, where a person is trying to sell his lot and somebody else goes off and buys some other lot, it's easy for us to draw a bright line and say he can't possibly intend to sell somebody else's lot.
Well, it makes a big difference if they don't pay up.
Pardon me, if they don't pay up on what?
On the bond.
To whom?
To the people who hold the bonds.
Well, it certainly makes a difference to people who hold the bonds, whether they pay up or not.
We could apply the same analysis to a situation where it's the person who bought the bond and they're waiting around to be paid up and they never pay up.
I don't follow the question exactly, but let me try this. The intent we look at is the actor's intent, the person charged with fraud, not the intent of the person who relies. That's a separate element. That's reliance down here. All kinds of people can rely on all sorts of things, but fraud is an intentional tort. And if there was no intent to harm or cause action, then it's not intentional. As Oliver Wendell Holmes said in his great work on the common law, even a dog distinguishes between being stumbled over and being kicked. This is about kicking. The question is, who'd you kick at? And if these are people that were not being kicked, then we don't have fraud. Maybe we have securities fraud, maybe we have negligent misrepresentation. Could I see my light is on. Could I have about 2 minutes to sum up?
Somebody wants you to sum up. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the arguments for today. The court will take all of these problems under submission on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
All right. Foyer. The Honorable Supreme Court of America.